Welcome to this episode of the Payments Show podcast. My name is Satwant Full, and today I will be speaking with Brandon Spear, who is the president of MSTS, which is a global B2B payment and credit solutions provider. The company is disrupting the global credit industry with credit as a service and other payment experiences which make B2B payments faster and easier than ever before. Enjoy the episode. Hello, Brandon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me today.
Thanks for coming on, especially during these crazy times of the lockdown. How has it been going for you?
I think much like everyone else, it takes some getting used to working from home all the time. But I got to say, I'm always very fortunate and grateful for the fact that we have a business that lends itself for most people working remotely. So whilst it's been challenging, we're still in the sort of industry that we've been able to be relatively successful with everyone still at home.
Yeah, we're very lucky, given the jobs that we do, to be able to do that. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. Before we get started, I always like to give a quick intro for the listeners. So Brandon Spear is the president of MSTS, which is a global B2B payment and credit solutions provider based in Kansas, USA. And the company is disrupting the global credit industry with credit as a service, which is a suite of applications and services that enables companies to have access to robust payment and credit solutions, sophisticated managed services, and expert-driven integrations for global commerce. So I hope that's a clear summary of what you guys do.
Well, wow, it sounds impressive.
So there's a lot to get through. I've got a whole bunch of questions lined up, so I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Before we get started, please introduce yourself and tell us a bit about how you got involved in payments, because I see you've had a career with SAP and Ariba and a few other companies. So it'd be great to describe your journey, because I think it helps especially business execs and owners to see where you're coming from.
Yeah, of course. And I'd love to. Thank you. So my background is mainly in software and technology businesses, and I've been fortunate enough to be in a variety of those types of businesses, generally speaking, in early stages of their life cycle. And prior to MSTS, I was in what became the largest internet service provider in South Africa. You can probably tell from the accent, I did not grow up in Kansas. So I was based in South Africa, started an ISP there in the 90s, which was obviously, you know, the perfect time to be doing that. Was then involved in a series of marketplace businesses, and we ended up in late 2009, 2010, selling that business, which was a procurement marketplace business, to Ariba. And then shortly thereafter, Ariba got acquired by SAP. And so I've always been in this buying and selling, well, for the last 20 years of my career, being in this buying and selling landscape. And what was interesting about my journey with Ariba and SAP is that at the time, they were not consummating the payments piece of the transaction. They were facilitating a lot of the data flows between the buyers and the sellers, but weren't actually helping with how the payment occurred. And it's ironic, because all those businesses were called procure to pay, but they were more like procure to invoice. They didn't really do the pay piece. So I had a lot of the background and context to how B2B transactions occur. And then this opportunity arose with MSTS. And I just generally have loved the space. So I've had a pretty fun time over the last 6 years with MSTS.
Yeah, I've spoken to quite a few people who have ended up where they are through acquisitions and mergers. So I especially found that with somebody from the subscription space. So it's crazy how the IT industry is evolving so fast.
Absolutely.
I'd love to move on to the whole suite of things that you offer to customers. I know credit as a service is a huge area. But before we go into that in detail, because I'm sure that I'll cover quite a bit of this discussion. You work with a number of industries, so manufacturing, I've seen sales, transportation, e-commerce, retail. Is there something you can discuss there at a high level in terms of those focus areas?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the first thing to say is that most of our focus is on the seller and really helping the seller deal in a more effective way with their buyers. And effectively, what we're doing is we're assisting them in doing all of the underwriting, credit provision services, how you manage your best buy-side customers. And, you know, what we've really found is that if you do that well, if you're better than the next guy in line, then you can actually have a larger share of your customer's wallet. So a big part of what all of our services is around is trying to help customers, sellers specifically, get that right. And if you look at some of the business process challenges in some of those industries, particularly in the B2B side of those industries, so for example, transportation or manufacturing. Manufacturing is a good one because you have someone who's making the product, but then there's a whole distribution chain of how they sell it. And more often than not, when they're selling to an end customer, or if they want to sell to an end customer, it's quite difficult for them to do because they usually have other parties in the middle. And so they're not necessarily certain what that customer is looking for or how they want to be dealt with. And so a lot of what our solution is really all about is about simplifying those data flows and those business processes between the seller and the buyer so that the buyer's procurement processes line up with how the seller wants to sell. And like I said, we found when you get that right, you actually drive a larger share of your customer's wallet because you're easier to deal with than the next person who's trying to sell to them.
Okay. I want to touch a bit more in detail about what you just said around a lot of the times companies are in the middle between the buyer and the seller.
Mm-hmm.
And you alluded to the fact that more of them are looking to sell goods directly to the end customer.
Or exactly. So there's some of that that's going on. I think we've all seen various industries be disrupted and changed, and that traditional distribution models are all shifting and pivoting. But there's also a scenario that occurs, and I'll give you a specific example. If you're a manufacturer of, for example, automotive equipment, you're usually selling through a dealership channel, and you still need that dealership channel because they're crucial for the service and maintenance of those vehicles afterwards. But if you're selling to a very large customer out there, more often than not, like a large fleet owner, those fleet owners tend to want to negotiate all the pricing directly with the OEM because they want to, you know, leverage their buying power to get the very best contract price. And if you extend that and say, okay, not only do I want to get the best contract price when I buy the goods, I actually want to lock in my aftermarket parts and maintenance costs as well, because that's when you're buying these assets, that's when you have your best opportunity to put those contracts in place. The challenge you have is how do you execute a contract like that through a dealership channel that's independent, that's not owned by the OEM? And so the OEM wants that business. They really want those large fleets to continue buying all of the aftermarket parts and service from them. But how could you establish a national contract where it doesn't matter which dealership chain you go to, you're going to get the same price?
Yeah.
And so that's a big part of what our platform does, as an example, is we can help reprice and manage all of those contracts that exist between these large buyers and these large manufacturers. But it's all ended up being executed through a dealership channel.
And in that example, the dealership's not uncomfortable with that scenario?
A great question. You know, the interesting thing is that in a lot of cases, the dealerships really want that business because these are the very largest customers that are out there. But often it's difficult business for them to manage because they can't just have their regular retail price. They've got to have separate contract pricing for all of these customers. They also have the challenge that although there might be hundreds of dealers that are interacting with a particular customer, all of the invoicing only goes to one place, and often it's challenging to fit in with the procurement practices of those large fleet customers. And so what ends up happening is that the dealers end up having large outstanding, you know, DSOs. It's challenging to collect the money. They don't necessarily format the invoices in the right way. The fleets are concerned that they're not getting the contract pricing, and so there's delays in the approval of invoices. So what ends up happening with that is it becomes a difficult customer base for them to deal with. And so by virtue of using our solution, we end up with a win-win-win for all three parties. The buyers love it because they get one consolidated invoice, even if they go to thousands of different dealerships. The dealers love it because they don't have to worry about chasing the money. They don't have to worry about getting the pricing right. And the OEMs love it because they get a larger share of those fleets spent.
Right. You're solving a whole bunch of problems in one hit.
Whole bunch of problems, and payments is a big piece of it, but honestly, a large portion of this is keeping all the contracts straight and keeping all the pricing right.
Right. Okay. I didn't think of the contract side of it. Huge benefit.
Yeah, it is. I think what we've learned out of this, particularly with business-to-business invoicing and the payments that obviously then go along with it, if you're going to be effective in payments, you need to be playing some sort of role in making sure that the invoice is right. If the invoice is incorrect, then you see lots of downstream challenges with payments, with cash flow, with money being paid late, etc.
Yeah, sure. And on that very topic of money being paid late, you've got a whole bunch of services around working capital, accounts receivable. So I'm guessing for your customers that those just by definition improve when they're using a solution like yours, right?
Yeah, they do. And so fundamentally what our proposition is all about is about deburdening those customers from having to manage and worry about the credit and underwriting processes, how much credit to give a customer, you know, the risks of bad debt that go along with that, obviously the deployment of the working capital as well. And then as part and parcel of that, we then manage all the collection of the monies. So in a lot of ways, back to that example I was referring you to, you know, we'll pay a dealer typically in 2 days or 7 days, and they get paid like clockwork. So the money just comes in, they're not having to chase it, they just get paid like clockwork. And then we take on the burden of dealing with the fleets, making sure that they get the invoice, making sure it goes into their procurement software, into their ERP software, and that we, in fact, end up getting paid at the end of that process. So it's really an outsourcing solution that encompasses the technology, which I referred to, the credit and underwriting pieces, customer support, and then the deployment of working capital, as well as then collecting all the money after the fact.
Let's talk about the main service that you offer, the credit as a service. Mm-hmm. Until I heard of your company, I'd never heard of that specific term before. So I'm really looking forward to finding out what that means and how you're disrupting the space. So what I've read about it, again, from your website, is the services encompasses efficient onboarding. You've got dynamic pricing and purchasing controls. And I saw you've got something called Invoice Me at the checkout. Mm-hmm. So it seems from the sounds of it, a very consumer type of payment system, but for businesses. So yeah, please tell us about that service in detail. How long has it been around?
Sure. So specifically, the problem we're trying to solve with credit as a service is if your primary sales channel is an e-commerce sales channel, we're able to execute everything we do in a multi-channel way. We can do it in physical stores. We can do it with a telesales team as well as e-commerce. But credit as a service is really geared at those companies that do the bulk of their selling via an e-commerce platform. And so what we're trying to do with that is really reduce the effort that it takes to get a new customer on board and for somebody to basically turn this on. And so what you want to have in a perfect world is that this new solution just appears as a different payment type. You might take credit cards today, you might take EFTs today, and you simply want to have a new payment type, which is called Invoice Me. And you use and deploy that solution for your customers that basically have a line of credit with you. Obviously, the other two payment types that I listed, those are, you know, either a line of credit with a bank or a line of credit with, not a line of credit, it's often you're paying before goods or services are delivered. And so This Invoice Me option is then a way for you to extend credit to your customers, do it off of your website, and do it via a very quick and easy to deploy solution. So we've built plugins to several of the large e-commerce platforms, the likes of Magento and BigCommerce and several others. And so that it's quick and easy for you as a seller to take that from that online marketplace that those vendors have, drop our plugin into your instance of that e-commerce software, and then basically you're off to the races. You can deploy the solution, you know, in a week, maybe 10 days. And then it's all integrated via API with our platform. So we will then do all the physical work as a new customer comes on and they're presented with Invoice Me as an option. The first time that they're presented with it, we'll actually collect data about them, underwrite them, provide them with a line of credit. And we can typically do that in minutes. And so they're actually able to consummate their first transaction with the credit line from your company. So that's the idea of it. It's really just taking all of those solutions we've had and deploy them in a very quick way so that you can get going very fast, which has been, by the way, incredibly interesting and powerful in the world we live in at the moment, where people want to have more volume through their e-commerce channels. Second part of your question, how long has it been around? It's been around for about 18 months. So we launched this in the fourth quarter of 18. It's been exciting to watch the take-up of it. We've got a number of new customers that we've been able to sign up for it.
I was going to say, you must have had a big spike in the last few weeks.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've had some of our deals that have slowed down, as you would expect. They're in industries that have been negatively impacted. But we've also had deals just massively accelerate, where it might normally take us 90 days to close a deal. We've had deals from start to finish get done in 3 weeks. So it's been amazing to see how everyone's trying to pivot their businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned to give that level of convenience and speed that one of the things you have to do as a business is the risk management side, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to minimize your risk, I'm assuming you have some kind of links into their bank accounts or some background data checks that you do. How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So a couple of things. The first is the credit application process is generally one of the most broken processes that exist inside of suppliers. It's usually painful and it's often paper-based and it's kind of a black hole. You can put your data in there and it may take days or weeks before you find out if you have a credit line. Yep. So what we're primarily trying to do is how can we deliver that service in a much faster, more customer-friendly way? So what we do is, depending on how you answer questions, and we typically are only looking for about 8 or 9 data points, depending on how you answer questions, we change the form that you fill in. So if you're a sole proprietor, you're going to fill in a very different form than if you're a corporate entity or a public company. And so we change that form, we gather those data points, we then hit sort of typical data sources, third-party data sources, and we do this in North America and in Europe and in Australia. We hit appropriate data sources in each of those countries to get a validation of the information from those customers to try to draw a view on what line of credit we could provide. And, you know, the other key piece to this, which is more prevalent in an e-commerce scenario, is you really have to weed out all of the fraudulent applications. And there's often a surprisingly large number of those, particularly if you have customers who are like electronics retailers or, you know, where they are selling equipment that's easy to buy and then sell somewhere else. And you've got to be particularly careful. So we have all of that connected in. We also use some sort of atypical data sources as well. So often a lot of the companies we're dealing with, particularly if their primary channel is e-commerce, they might not have been around for very long. And one of the challenges you have with traditional data sources is that if they don't have 2 or 3 years worth of history, you have a challenge developing a credit view. Yep. And so we look at venture capital funding sources, we look at their social media pages to try to get a holistic view of what is this company doing? A, are they a real business? And then B, do they look like they are growing? And then on the back of that, we make the credit decision.
So you're basically going from days or weeks to, would you say, a day or two or hours even?
In some cases, about 30 or 40% of the time, we can actually provide the credit line in less than a minute. Our goal ultimately is to try to get that percentage up to, you know, above 50% into the 60s. But we have SLAs with all of our customers where we will underwrite somebody in 4 hours. More often than not, the reason it's not been able to be concluded online is that there's discrepancy in the data, or they might not have filled in the name of the business exactly. There might be difficult for us to determine the actual company name. And so we often need to get some clarity from them. But, you know, we have pretty stringent SLAs with our customers to turn that around very fast.
Excellent. I know you mentioned a few countries earlier. What countries do you currently operate in? You mentioned Australia.
Yeah, so we operate in Canada, the US, Mexico. We operate in 21 countries in Europe. So all of the countries really that are part of the Eurozone. We also deal with all of the various currencies that are not euro, so pounds and Swiss francs and all the Nordic currencies and some of the Eastern European currencies. And then we also operate in Australia and New Zealand.
Excellent. And are you looking at expanding in any other markets in future?
Yeah, we are. I mean, so the interesting thing is a lot of our customers are very global businesses. We have some really large accounts that we work with, and we've been fortunate enough that we've followed them as they've moved into different markets. And so I think the two next geographies that we'll be tackling is South America. Some of our customers have got operations in Brazil and Colombia, Peru, Chile. So those are sort of the next logical set of countries that we'd be focusing on. And then I think ultimately Southeast Asia. You know, Asia is a relatively complex market to enter, but we certainly believe that there's lots of opportunity in that market as well. So Latin America next, South America next, and then ultimately Southeast Asia.
Yeah, sure. Big contrast between Asia and America, especially the difference in the level of advancement of payment technology in general. I noticed one of the articles on your blog, and I've seen similar articles over the past couple of years around the US and checks.
Mm-hmm.
How so many systems are built around checks and optimized for sending things out in the post. It's more the hard coding from many years of these systems being in operation, so it kind of makes more sense. So are you finding in the States, say, versus Europe or Asia, that the States is kind of accelerating a move away from that old world system, or are you still finding it's taking quite a bit of time?
It's definitely taking quite a bit of time, and I think part of it, that's really what you're implying, is the inertia of the existing processes. It's just hard to change. Now, ironically enough, the world we live in now with the COVID virus is actually driving some of that behavioral change. You know, if you have to physically print out and cut physical checks, it's really challenging to do that in a world where you're trying to have everyone work from home. And so we've been running campaigns with our customers. They've actually been proactively reaching out to us, because roughly 50% of our volume in the US today, when we're getting paid, is paper check. And, you know, that's remarkably inefficient and remarkably old school. But, you know, I think catalysts like this, like what we're all dealing with at the moment, are likely to accelerate what was actually quite a slow process before.
Yeah. Let me turn that question on its head. The UK has got fast payments. Australia and New Zealand have got pretty good payment systems as well. And Europe kind of varies, but there's still more electronic payments happening in Europe than the States. So on the flip side of the question, do you find it takes more time for your solution to gain traction in those markets?
Not really, because the biggest piece of the value that we're providing to our customer base is a lot of the credit and underwriting and kind of the risk taking on the profile of their customers. And then also the technology that we wrap around this that makes sure that the invoice is correct and that we make sure that the invoice gets to the buyer in a format that they can easily consume. Because that's the other piece of this, is if you have a paper invoice that's going out and the buyer wants it in an ERP system or a procurement system, that can be a big source of pain and a cause for delay. And so what we end up seeing is that, you know, in the United States, you get the check is in the mail quote all the time, which basically means you buy yourself another 6 or 7 days of working capital because of the physical mailing and lockbox processes. You tend to not have that in the European context. I mean, to your point, real-time payments and the money basically being able to be in your bank account for that same day, that means that you don't have that excuse, and it's much quicker for the money to hit your account. But it still doesn't change the rest of the value proposition, which is, if somebody is delayed in approving the invoice because the data is wrong or it's not in their system, you're still going to get paid late. It's now not the banking system's problem. It's the process problems inside those buyers. And so that's a huge part of what, you know, the value proposition and what we solve for the sellers we work with.
Sure. I saw that you are really focusing on marketplaces either now or about to in the future.
Yep.
And I saw some information about connected commerce. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting because some of my background has been in with marketplaces and procurement platforms. And for the longest time, those marketplaces have really been sourcing platforms, been a way for buyers and sellers to find each other. And we've seen a really interesting uptick in the number of marketplaces that are trying to add payment to their solutions. And I think part of it is, you know, some of it might be driven by global players like Amazon and the impact that they're having. And because they have a turnkey offering, I think other marketplaces that are more niche feel like they need to be the same. But there's been a really interesting uptick in marketplaces approaching us and asking for help with providing solutions to their customers. And obviously, you know, the easiest thing for them to do is plug in credit cards. But if you're a B2B marketplace, what you discover really quickly is that there's a very small number of transactions that B2B buyers want to have on a credit card. More often than not, they need an invoice, they need purchase order data on there, they need other things that will help them get the invoice paid. And they don't want to stick it on a credit card because, it, you know, typically the size of purchases is larger than you typically want to have on a credit card. Yeah. We also see the other interesting kind of side effect of that is there's not necessarily a lot of sellers that want to take credit cards for large B2B transactions. And a lot of that's got to do with the chargeback rules that are very buyer friendly. And you need a more balanced dispute management process, particularly with larger transactions. So it's interesting, and there's been a ton of interest in marketplaces, and so we've been working really hard on that segment.
Have you got any examples of which marketplaces, or you can't really talk about them?
We have a great one that I'd love to talk about, but it's not public yet, unfortunately, but it's one of the largest marketplaces in the world, and we are incredibly excited about what it could mean, and we'll let you know as soon as that breaks, but we've got a really big customer that's about to go live.
Sure. Well, maybe we can talk about some public customer case studies. And if not, perhaps some of the traits and similarities you see of customers that do sign up with you.
Yeah. So I think we see customers really in two segments, the two primary value propositions that resonate. The one is businesses that are having difficulty or kind of outgrowing the pace that they can produce working capital at. And so those tend to be higher growth businesses or in some cases, younger businesses. And if their business really starts to accelerate, they can have a really tough time getting traditional sources of financing for the working capital that they need to be able to grow their companies. And so we see a lot of companies that are very similar in that regard. The main reason they gravitate to our solution is that they don't have to fund from when they sell the goods, product or service to when they eventually get paid by the customer. So we see that group of customers. I think then the second primary group of customers we see is where there's either a complicated business process or a little bit like the example I was referring to earlier with automotive manufacturers, where there's a distribution channel and there's a two or a three or even a four-way relationship between various players in the distribution channel and the end customer. And there, the value proposition is typically not so much about working capital. It's much more about getting the invoice right. And then as a consequence of getting the invoice right, being able to get a larger share of your customer's wallet. So it's much more about how you can improve your customer loyalty. Now, the end result of both of those is growth. And that's a big part of how we talk to anyone we have a discussion with. Is how can we help you grow? And that almost always means more credit lines, larger credit lines, faster ability to turn them around, getting the invoices right so that people can spend more.
Yeah. One question I've thought of, based on what's happening in consumer, do you think that over time, more and more businesses will want to deal directly with end customers? I mean, you can't do it with everything. You know, you're not going to drive your Ford car to the manufacturing site for a service, but do you think that there's just simply going to be more consolidation of businesses in general, which don't necessarily need to go through a middleman?
Yeah, we're seeing it in a variety of industries, everything from manufacturers who are making like landscaping bricks that would sell those things traditionally through a hardware store or through professional installers and wanting to go direct to the actual contractors who are actually, you know, interacting with the end customer. Even PC manufacturers who would typically sell through a distribution channel who want to start selling directly and sell off of their websites have become customers of ours. And so I think what you're talking about is exactly what we're seeing occurring. And I think the role of the distributor is going to have to shift and pivot more towards services and less to around the sale of the actual product. And particularly if you can scale, because, you know, one of the reasons that those distributors existed is that the OEMs didn't necessarily want to break the bulk, so to speak. They wanted to have tens of very large distribution channels that they used, and those were easier for them to operate with rather than thousands or tens of thousands of much smaller customers. Yeah. However, with e-commerce, with solutions like ours, where they can basically outsource this stuff, there's way more options for them to say, okay, you know, this segment, like the SMB segment, is often a segment we talk to larger customers about. They want to go direct to an SMB segment. they don't have the skill set in-house or the capacity in-house to scale around that. And so they outsource it, and it's a quick and relatively easy decision. They get to be closer to their customer. So yep. There's a lot of that that's going on. And the other interesting thing is it's cross-industry. There's some industries that are moving faster than others, but we see it happening almost everywhere.
Yeah. I don't think necessarily everything's going to disappear, because on the flip side, you know, Dell always used to be a direct company in terms of PCs. Yeah. And then they ended up selling through the channel eventually because they hit their growth ceiling with direct.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing to your point, right, is that what this drives is a pivot in how and what traditional distributors do, where a big part of the value proposition in the past of traditional distributors was what I'm referring to, providing the credit lines, dealing with the end customers, perhaps holding inventory, and so you could get something quickly. And I think that's pivoting more towards services. You know, so for example, some of the customer base we have sell to entities like school districts. And so in that scenario, you know, most school districts don't have the wherewithal, for example, in the summer, to do a wipe of all the iPads or all the laptops and, you know, set up clean images on all of those machines so that the new crop of students coming in have a clean device. And so that traditional distributor role has pivoted to that. That's what they do. They'll go out and provide all the services around that, but the equipment is being sold directly by the OEM.
Yeah. I'd love to move on to one of the major parts of your offering as well, which is hooking into solutions from your technology partners.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming you would link into, say, accounting software, and you mentioned like business process workflow. Can you talk around that? And it probably links into what you said very early on in the podcast around being able to set things up quickly and ease of sign up.
Yeah,
sure. It'd be great if you could talk about who you work with, what are the benefits, and how that benefits customers.
Yeah, of course. So I think there's two or three broad areas where we've got a lot of integration work that's been done already. So we've touched on one of them, which is the e-commerce platforms, where you really want to be able to just quickly and easily drop our solution into an e-commerce platform. We appear as a new payment type called InvoiceMe, and you know, you're basically off to the races once you've done that. We also have integrations that we've built on the sell side that, depending on the industry that you're in. So if I go back to that automotive example, in the United States, there's 12 or 13 different dealer management software platforms. In Europe, there's about 80. And we've integrated with the vast majority of those DMSs so that we can take all of the line level detail that you need to put on an invoice out of the DMS and send it to the buyer, send it to that large fleet in that example that I was referring to. Okay. So we've done a lot of work around what the actual kind of ERP platform is for the seller so that we can get the line level detail we need. On the buy side, we also have, like you would expect, hundreds of integrations with different ERP software and procure to pay software, you know, the SAPs, the Oracles, the Bazwares, the Coopers, all of those different software vendors that are either running the ERP software or the procurement software. Now, whilst we're on this topic, you know, one of the things that we're seeing as a trend, which is really painful for sellers, is that more and more often buyers don't actually want to do a physical integration, even if you are a large volume supplier to them. What they'll say to you is, you need to capture your invoice into my invoice portal. So they don't want to deal with a paper invoice. They don't even want to deal with an email-based invoice. They want you to go and key it into their portal. And you can imagine if you're a seller and you've got hundreds of buyers that have that request of you, that becomes a very painful and expensive activity. And so, you know, that's the reason we have all of these out-of-the-box integrations that we can very quickly and easily turn that on for all the buyers that they deal with, and then, you know, essentially they don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that sounds like a world of hell that can be avoided, because you just get an opportunity for more mistakes and errors, and then you have downflow effects from one mistake, and it can magnify, right?
That's exactly right. And part of what the buyers have done with this, which from their perspective is a beautiful solution, well, if you key the invoice incorrectly, it's not my fault. I'm going to pay you late because you put in the data incorrectly. So The more you can eliminate that sort of swivel chair integration, have it be machine to machine, and as a consequence, you're not going to have errors.
Yeah. I'd love to understand a bit around the market what you see are the weaknesses of existing solutions out there.
Like, sure.
I'm sure there are competitors that you have, and really within that area, where you see yourselves delivering that extra value or advantage, and what you see are the weaknesses of other players out there.
Right. So I think the easiest place to start with that question is some of the alternative offerings that are out there. And the simplest one and most common one is obviously a credit card or an EFT. Obviously, with a credit card, you have the challenges around the dispute process. You have the challenges around not having a lot of flexibility on what you can offer to your customer. The other real problem in B2B is B2B customers generally don't want to pay a statement. They want to pay an individual invoice. So they want to say, okay, I got 10 invoices from you. 9 of these are okay. 1 isn't. I'm going to pay you for the 9 and we'll sort out number 10. That's not correct. So in a high volume or a repetitive relationship between buyers and sellers, that's a challenge. So answering your question, to really be effective in B2B, you have to have lots of options and lots of choices that you can provide to both the seller and to the buyer. And so I'll give you some examples. So on the sell side, you want to be able to offer your buyer a variety of reimbursement terms. And that's all affects how much working capital they consume. Do you want to get paid in 2 days, 7 days, 14 days, 30 days? You similarly want to segment your buyer base, and you're not necessarily going to offer the same sort of payment terms or invoicing frequency to all of your buyers. You might offer, for example, 60-day terms and a monthly invoice, which basically means they get 75-day terms to your very best customers. And customers who have a newer relationship with you, you might do daily billing with 30-day terms, which means they basically get 30 days on every invoice. And you need to have all of that as a range of options so that you could do daily, weekly, biweekly, monthly billing so that you can have, you know, 7 days, 14 days, 30 days, 45 days, 60 days, 90 days, all those different payment terms. And so I think a big part of how we position ourselves and how we position our value proposition is that you can curate that experience for your buyers, that you're in a position to segment the different types of customers you have and construct solutions and payment term options for each of them. And again, that's part of the idea of if you do that correctly, you can drive more value, more volume from those particular buyers. And then we've touched on some of our other technology advantages around really trying to help with contract pricing. Our solution is also omni-channel, and that's, you know, more or less relevant depending on how large the customer is. But for example, we often see more of a sort of equal split between physical store sales done through a telesales organization and done on an e-commerce website. And no matter how your customer interacts with you, they really should have the same experience. So if they walk into a physical store and buy something, it shouldn't be different from if they're buying it on the e-commerce site or if they phone a salesperson for help. So that omni-channel capability, I think, is also a big part of what we see as being lacking, but it's also hard to execute, which is why you don't see everyone doing it.
Yeah, you've got to look at the user experience, and whether it's a consumer or a business, somebody's having a user experience, right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, you're on an incredibly important point. And often when we talk to our customers, we say to them that historically there's been brand loyalty. You'd go to a specific brand and you'd buy from the brand because the brand had a value associated with it. More and more often, it's experience loyalty. That if you have a better experience with somebody, that's where you'll go rather than necessarily the brand per se. And not everyone gets that. And if you don't get that, I think that's been a big part of why we've seen so many industries end up getting disrupted, is that it's just easier. And the people who are solving these problems the best are getting a disproportionate part of the market.
Yeah, that reminds me of an article I read a couple of years ago where the tech journalist spoke to a CEO of a consumer company, and he was saying, look, how can I stop people complaining about my company on Twitter? And he said, like, I didn't feel comfortable saying to this guy, well, actually, that's all the weaknesses of your current business. That's actually right. An opportunity.
Yeah.
But he just saw it as something that needed to be sort of swept away.
Yeah.
that data exactly is actually a gold mine for actually, you don't have to actually hire any consultants to figure out what needs to be improved. Everything's there right in front of you.
That's exactly right. And, you know, all of us in the business world are also consumers. And so your consumer experiences and what you have as an expectation as a consumer is bleeding into what your expectations are in the B2B world. And it's remarkable still how far behind the B2B world is.
I think companies like yours, what you're doing with InvoiceMe, and you've got companies like Xero that are making B2B accounting really slick and a mm-hmm. consumer-like experience. And I think more and more companies like you guys are going to change this faster rather than necessarily getting the other companies to change. I just think personally that a lot of companies won't be able to transition and make all these improvements in aggregate, and they'll just get disrupted like what you guys are doing to your competitors.
Yeah, I think that these are incredibly interesting times that we're living in. And I certainly feel that also what we're experiencing with this pandemic is going to be a catalyst for how people think about their businesses going forward. And if you have an inflexible business model, or you don't have a lot of automation in your business model, and if you require, you know, and there are obviously certain industries where people have to be in a factory, or where they have to be in a meat processing plant, or, you know, they have to physically be in a location. But there's vast other segments of the economy which are services based where that's not necessarily true. And there's a lot of people who are behind. And I think coming out of this whole pandemic, there's going to be a resurgence in unpacking. How do I pivot? How do I make my business model more flexible? How do I get more things automated? How do I move away from paper checks? But there's going to be a lot of that, I think.
That's actually a perfect move into the next two questions. What do you think are the biggest challenges in the payment industry right now? And something that almost nobody agrees with you on.
So biggest challenges in the payment industry is that there's so much inertia behind some of the existing solutions that are in place. And there's also a tremendous amount of legislative and regulatory inertia. It's just, it's really hard to develop new solutions because there's so much governance and oversight. And so, you know, I think in some respects, I'm really fortunate that we're in an entity, an organization that, you know, we're not a bank, we're not part of a bank. And so you don't have that same regulatory burden that really, in a lot of ways, makes it difficult for you to innovate. So I'm not sure that we've quite as an industry figured out the balance there between allowing innovation and allowing things to advance, and at the same time recognizing that it's a pretty crucial part of the economy and that you can't have the Wild West. And I think you always see this pendulum swing between too much regulation and too little regulation, and I'm not sure we've found the balance. I think we're probably on the side of too much regulation at the moment. It's really difficult for innovation to occur. So I think that's the biggest challenge in the payment industry. In terms of the thing that people disagree with me most, I'm going to throw something out there that's not business related at all.
Okay.
So I've been living in the States for 14 years now. And I find it hysterically funny that most Americans think that a baseball game takes too long, and it's only 3.5 hours. And having grown up in South Africa, and you know, you've obviously experienced it too, I talk to Americans about cricket and say, you know, we have a game that takes 5 days, and there can be no result at the end of the 5 days. So anyway, almost everyone I talk to thinks that baseball's way too long. That 3.5 hours is too long for a sport.
It's quite funny. I remember when the World Cup was on in the States many years ago, and the TV networks, I think, were trying to pressure FIFA to have quarters. So
that's funny. That is really funny.
I think the response was no way in hell, but obviously gave it a go.
It's really funny. Anyway.
Coming back to your question, maybe mixing in with this regulation and government, there's a whole bunch of macro stuff going on globally that's going to have a huge impact on things we can predict and also not predict. So just wanted to get your general thoughts around, you know, we've got the US elections coming up this year, we've got trade wars, Brexit, a lot of civil unrest in many countries, and nobody could have thought of the pandemic. But what are your thoughts on how macro is going to affect commerce, specifically payments, perhaps, if you got a view on that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really unpredictable, to your point. And the impacts of some of the tensions in trade even some of the tensions that are occurring now as a consequence of the pandemic, whether it's social unrest inside of countries or whether it's finger pointing going on with where the virus originated from or how it originated. I think all of that just creates a, you know, a general sense of unease. And the more I talk to other colleagues and peers in my market here in the US, the more kind of concerned we are as to when consumers are actually going to start feeling good again, because we all live in economies that are very consumer driven.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it's like for you, but you know, when you go out to the grocery store or, you know, you go to pick something up, it's weird interacting with people these days.
And it's very strange. Yeah.
It's strange. And so there's going to have to be, maybe it's a vaccine or something else, I think, before there's really and truly a return to normalcy. Because I think everyone is still anxious and to some extent afraid of still getting this virus. So I think the thing that worries me most is that things are starting to open up again, but I don't think they're going to come back with the speed that most people think they will. Because yeah. I think the consumers are still fundamentally anxious.
Yeah, and people have varying degrees of fear, I've noticed. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I've been to the grocery store here in Southwest England, where I am right now, and I haven't really changed my behavior too much. And there's other people like that, but there's other people who, even if you get 1 centimeter to their danger zone, what they've got in their head, they just give you a funny look.
Yeah.
So you're seeing extremes, but then that comes back to why e-commerce is potentially going to be a new tier of revenue, which will just stay there.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah. And even people using e-commerce for the first time, like older generations as well, they won't go back either, because they'll think, oh, what was I scared about for so long?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, exactly. Some of the articles I've read have talked about the pandemic being a catalyst for a structural change in how economies operate. But in 4 or 5 years from now, we'll look back and go, well, that's when it started. That's really when there was a pivot away from, and maybe it's travel, not traveling as much for business. Like I can see just in our own company how effective tools like, you know, Zoom and video conferencing and others have been. And that's creating all kinds of conversation. Do I need as much office space? Do we need to be face-to-face when we do business meetings? Can we not do more of these via Zoom? So I think there's going to be some structural shifts, and it's going to change how I think a lot of things work in the future.
And I think also, personally, if you're doing a job which is very repetitive, I think if you're at home doing that, it's going to become more unbearable. And those are the kind of jobs that would actually serve a business and the employee to automate.
Yeah.
Because that person can then do something more fulfilling,
more interesting,
more valuable.
Yeah.
So I think it might have benefits for both the employees and the businesses to use this as an opportunity to think, what can we just get rid of forever and get some computer to do it?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
So let's talk about the future. What are your company's biggest goals right now? Have you got any new services or products coming out within the next 12 months that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, so our main focus is to continue to build out the ecosystem for the CaaS product offering that we have for the credit as a service, and get integrated with more marketplace vendors, get integrated with more e-commerce vendors, and just continue to build out that ecosystem so that it's easier and easier for prospective customers to get on the platform and get going. I think we also have some objectives around moving into a couple of new geographies like South America, parts of Asia. They'll be on the radar screen for the next couple of months, for the next couple of years. We did have plans actually in the back half of this year to go into Latin America, but they're probably on hold now.
Yeah.
Geographic expansion and really trying to drive, you know, a larger and larger ecosystem so it's easier for our customers to get on board.
Any predictions for this year in terms of the payment space?
You know, what's going to be interesting, I don't know if this is a prediction, but more just kind of an observation. I wonder, you know, there was such a frenzy of M&A activity that was going on in the payment space. I don't know the exact numbers offhand, but some of the numbers of transactions and the sizes of the deals were enormous. So I wonder whether that's going to return, and if it does, how it's going to return, and whether it's similar to what we were talking about earlier, whether a lot of the problems that are being solved in the fintech space are actually all about automation, all about doing things differently, all about disrupting industries. And that actually could become even more front and center as we come out of the pandemic and figure out what our new futures look like.
Yeah, a lot of startups are not making profits, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that unless they figure that out soon, some will just drop by the wayside or get acquired very quickly.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think if you're a startup and not making money, it's going to be a tough time right now, because sources of capital and sources of funding are going to be harder and harder to get. And if you're short of capital, it's going to be a tough place to be.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so let's finish on a few lighter things. Your favorite money movie? I like asking this one, and I'm going to adapt it a bit, because my last guest said, well, I don't really watch much movies, so I read a lot. So either your favorite audiobook or movie or whatever you prefer around money. Yeah.
My favorite money movie is probably The Big Short.
Yep.
Which, and for a couple of reasons, 2008 was kind of a traumatic time for, you know, a lot of us, and having a movie that helped explain it, because I think for the layperson, how all of it was put together and why things collapsed the way they did was kind of hard to get your head around. And the movie was so good that I actually read the book as well, which was, as usual, the book's always better than the movie, but that's probably my favorite movie about money.
Excellent. And I always have a few to choose from here at the end, but I go with, what's the best advice you received ever?
So during 2008, the business we were in at the time, we had to let a whole lot of people go, which is, you know, if you ever have to live through that, that's a painful experience. And I had a boss at the time who said to me, it was really simple advice, this too shall pass.
Yeah.
And it was incredibly good advice, because it grounds you in the sense that no matter how bad things are, normalcy will return. And
yeah.
I reflect back on that with what we're all dealing with now. I mean, I really kind of come back to that advice at times like this and just try to remember it. I'm not always that good at remembering it, by the way. My wife sometimes has to prompt me, but it's great advice and something I've used ever since he shared it with me.
That's definitely good advice. Just keep going. That's half the battle, right?
Yeah, that is. Just exactly. Just keep going. You know, keep plowing ahead. Exactly, right.
Excellent. And finally, where can listeners and potential customers get in touch with you and find out more info?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So our website, there's a lot of interesting information on our website, msts.com.
Yeah.
And we've got some pretty interesting content there. It sounds like you've had a look around there as well.
Yeah, I bookmarked it. There's some great blog posts there.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're enjoying the movie.
I think regardless of whether you're in payments, it's a lot of stuff on the economy that you can find out from payments companies' blogs.
Yeah, you're 100% right. We've also recently, and you'll find this on the website too, done a survey with a whole number of buyers. And we'll share that content with whoever comes onto our website. What we're really trying to help with, you know, the sellers with is understand what the buyer's priorities are and what they care about and why they would spend more with one supplier versus another. So there's some really interesting data in there that we'd be, you know, more than happy to share. In terms of conferences, I'd love to tell you we have a defined calendar, but the world is so up in the air right now. We typically attend B2B conferences, and there's in fact several in both the US and UK and Europe that we typically go to.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're not sure if they're going to happen yet, or if they do happen, in what form. But we have all of that listed out on our website as well. So the website is probably the best place to find us, find out what we're doing, and there's also some interesting content there.
Great. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed that. I learned a lot, especially the nuances of what's happening in the B2B space is really key, I think.
Well, it was great chatting with you. Thank you. You know, I've done a lot of these, and you were really well prepared for our discussions today. So that's always fun. Thank you for being as well prepared as you were.
Oh, no worries at all. Thanks for that. I like to prepare really well. I'd rather have more info to discuss than less, you know?
Exactly. Well, it was great chatting with you. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Brandon, and look forward to catching up with you in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to The Payments Show on your favorite podcast app. If you would like to accept payments faster in your company, please head over to digitalmoneylab.com where you can find more information. Thanks for listening and see you in the next episode.